I think this is a very timely session with all of the changes that we've seen in our industry over the last few years. There's been a considerable amount of upheaval and displacement among the advisor community. And I think, though, for many independent firms, that's really represented an opportunity, a recruiting opportunity. And so our panelists today are going to talk to us about how to make the most of that opportunity. And so I'd like to introduce immediately to my right here is Mary Seek, who's the president of the Financial Services Group for Management Advisors International. And to her right is Chris Flint, who's vice president and head of advisor acquisition and strategy for the Lincoln Financial Network. And so they're going to share their ideas on this recruiting opportunity. So I'll turn it over to Mary and Chris. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks, Sherry.
Welcome. I hope everybody had an opportunity to enjoy everything the great city of New Orleans has to offer in terms of the culture, cuisine, and certainly the nightlife. It's really hard to believe just 4.5 years ago that the city was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. And now it's ranked one of the best places to live and work in the country. It's truly amazing. It really speaks to the fortitude of the American people, and certainly when we put our efforts together, what we can accomplish. And from my perspective, gives us great hope for the people of Haiti and all that we're contributing as a nation and certainly internationally. So I believe that country too will emerge a better, more prosperous nation as a result of our help there. And whatever you and your companies are doing, I think is certainly going far. As Terry mentioned, we're going to share with you today some best practices as it relates to recruiting in the marketplace. This is really a consensus of information. So as we look out across the industry, we have a great deal of proprietors of good information, good statistically relevant data as it relates to advisor migration trends in the marketplace. So the information that we're presenting today is a consensus of information we've observed personally, or that we've read about through the Tversian studies, Moss Adams studies, Pershing's Talent Connect, Chip Rome and his team, Cerulean Associates. So this information is readily available in the marketplace. We'll try to put our perspective on it and share with you why we think it's impactful for your organizations on a go-forward basis. We're going to cover, again, just high-level market observations, what we're seeing in the industry, its impact on recruiting, and then try to describe to you specifically some best practices that we see as it relates to creating some brand identity differentiation in your marketplace, recruiting structure, onboarding in the marketplace, and then just some general best practices that you don't necessarily have to have an effective recruiting strategy, but what we think will truly create a more efficient process within your organization. The format of the presentation is we're going to have these little arrows at the bottom for you. If I can make this work. Ignore that section on my bio that says I have a master's in technology. It's expired. The arrows will sort of signify where we are in the presentation. So again, we're going to spend a little bit of time going through some industry highlights and try to make those relevant to what's going on in the marketplace, specifically to the influence it's going to have on recruiting. I suspect many of you, if you didn't know already, certainly know now that we are in the middle of some of the most significant regulatory reform our industry and certainly any of us in our respective careers have ever experienced. This is going to have, I think, a great deal of influence, both current and prospectively, on how we recruit in the marketplace as well as the opportunities that we're seeing across our industry. And this reform will not discriminate. As the financial crisis did not discriminate, it's going to affect all segments of our industry. So whether you're a national firm in the insurance marketplace, you're a national firm in the wirehouse space, a regional boutique, advisor, client, independent RIA, this disruption will create some dislocation across all segments of the industry and certainly create opportunity for those firms that are well-positioned with a very articulate, concise value proposition and recruiting strategy to grow in the marketplace. We're also seeing, as a result of some of this reform, firms reevaluate where they want to be and what their core competencies are. Much like any industry, when it's under distress, firms go back to what they know best. We saw this with the insurance-owned retail distribution platforms. If you recall, in the early to mid-90s, I was just really starting my career at that time, but there was a fevered effort by a lot of manufacturers to get into independent distribution for two purposes. Really, they saw the trend, they were afraid of the trend, and they wanted to be able to have their products introduced to those independent advisors and their respective clients. At the same time, they wanted to soften some of the migration that was occurring from career agency distribution channels to independents. The market that we just came through has a lot of those firms reevaluating whether this is something they want to do, whether it's investment management, retail distribution through independent broker-dealers. Part of it was a capital raise. They had to do it. And others just realized they couldn't harmonize and create distribution in a meaningful way. This in itself has created a great deal of disruption in the marketplace. We saw some of the activity by LPL purchasing the PAC Select broker-dealers, Lightyear purchasing the ING firms, potentially and rumored to have possibly been interested in buying the AIG firms. We just saw Nationwide Securities announce that they're going to get out of retail distribution altogether. This type of dislocation is meaningful in the industry. It causes other firms to reevaluate how they're approaching the business and can they themselves manufacture product and send it through a different channels of independent distribution or through a well-defined wholesaling strategy. This creates opportunity, and I suspect many of the firms in this audience probably had their best recruiting year ever in 2008 and 2009 as a result of some of this. What we found is those firms that are engaged in the industry can spot trends, tend to benefit by being ahead of the curve and participating in it fully. The other areas that we're seeing occur across the marketplace that are causing firms to reevaluate is margin compression. It's no secret the independent broker-dealer community is oftentimes participating in various sources of revenue, from commission retention to money market remuneration to product manufacturer reallowance. All these things were put under pressure. Commission fees, I saw some statistic here recently that suggested that the average fee on advice went from 111 basis points down to 90. That doesn't reverse itself. That trend's for real, and it's kind of hard to go back to those clients and say, yeah, I know I reduced your fee because we're in a crisis situation, but now I'm going to raise it back because things are good again. That's real. We're seeing more dissolution of broker-dealers in general. If you look across the past 4 to 5 years, I believe we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,100 or so broker-dealers at the end of 2004, 2005. We're now sitting just at about 4,700 broker-dealers. Some of this was through the integration of broker-dealers that had previously purchased and haven't been integrated. Some of that was a result of firms getting into net capital violations. Some of those firms sold themselves and became large producing branches. We suspect that this is going to continue as we experience some of the byproduct of all the discussion that the regulators are having today and the cost and operating exposure, both liability and operating costs associated with regulatory reform and supervisory reform within the marketplace. Again, creates great opportunity for those firms that are well capitalized and well positioned, both in terms of their brand, how they communicate that brand, and how they face off in the marketplace from a recruiting perspective. The other emerging trend that I think is significant that we as an industry, and specifically in the independent broker-dealer community, need to pay particular attention to is the trend of advisors, whether it be breakaway advisors or advisors currently affiliated with our organization, moving to the third-party RIA custodians. This trend, if we're not anticipating it today, you need to. It's real. I just read something yesterday from the PR spokesperson for TD Ameritrade that they're 30% up over an undisclosed number from prior year. And as a recruiting professional, I know how to manipulate those stats as well. But it's still significant in terms of they're in the market, they want to play there, and they're going to do well, I believe, and be a real competitor going forward. Schwab is having similar success in the marketplace. They've started to establish recruiting teams that look much like some of our larger independent broker-dealer recruiting teams to attract more revenue and independent distribution through their advisors. Many industry experts have a perspective that the independent broker-dealer is a stepping stone for these individuals to go to an independent RIA-only relationship. And I believe it is if we don't see some consistency in terms of the regulatory requirements and supervisory requirements within the independent RIAs and the broker-dealer hybrids. So a trend we need to pay particular attention to. I think it's an opportunity to capitalize on some of the breakaway broker in the marketplace, but it could also be a threat to us on a go-forward basis if we're not embracing that type of platform within our organization. Some of the high-level recruiting observations that we're seeing. I apologize, I'm not keeping up with these slides here. Is this movement towards independence. I think that trend's real in the marketplace, but it's oftentimes overplayed, meaning that a lot of the migration, if you study the pattern, and there's multiple sources to study this pattern, from your clearing firm to the databases that the state, the states publish and the lead source providers publish, that will show you that the migration is really in between independent broker-dealer platforms. In general, the trend is moving towards independence, but a lot of the growth that we're seeing is happening within independence trading places with other independent broker-dealers. We expect this trend is going to continue somewhat in the marketplace, but generally it's a little bit overspoken. As it relates to advisors moving out of the wirehouse community, this trend is real from a survey perspective. If you interview your or you sample the regional and national wirehouse community, the majority of them point to the independent broker-dealer platform as being their affiliation of choice if they were to make a change. If you start to study the statistics around who's actually moving, and I'm sure somebody can provide some testament to this in the audience, that trend is minimal. There's a lot of interest, a lot of inquiry, but few platforms were able to fully plug these individuals into their organization, and as a result, they moved to other wirehouse firms. Where we're seeing the most significant transition from the wirehouse community is with the regionals. In many ways, they're set up in a semi-independent environment already today. If you look at some of the large national regional firms, Edward Jones is one that sort of sticks out to me. They're out there by themselves. They are managing a practice. They have one support or two support persons in their branch. Jones is providing all the infrastructure. These individuals are one step away from being a truly independent platform. So we're seeing more migration out of the regionals. What we've seen with wirehouse representatives going to a pure independent without infrastructure and support around it is they tend to migrate back to the wirehouse platform if you don't have infrastructure and resources to help them assimilate, much the way you assimilate a small business into your organization. The other pieces I want to point out that I think are relevant are, as you look across most broker-dealers, and I'm sure many of these, many in the audience here, you look at external recruiting as being the primary source of new revenue. And I only point this out because as we explore further in the presentation, this is relevant in terms of some of the risk I think we have in the industry with advisor headcount and I think a shrinking population of the ideal profile that a lot of us are looking for in recruiting from a recruiting perspective. Service and culture are often considered the most important considerations when somebody's changing a broker-dealer. I've yet to come across an organization who says we have lousy service and our culture's not so great, right? Everybody talks about service and culture, so it's very difficult to differentiate yourself on those attributes. Why it's important or how it can become important and relevant in the decision-making process is how you communicate and illustrate that you're a service-centric organization with a great culture. A lot of that comes through having a well-established advisor referral network, and Mary and I'll talk a little bit more about that further in the presentation. The other area that's important to know is most firms are looking at the internal recruiting structure as their most important lever for attracting new advisors. I know there's some organizations out here that have tried to do that through branch recruiting, and we think that's a viable strategy and something that firms need to have in place, but we'll spend some time with you talking about how you can leverage an internal recruiting strategy against an external model with branch recruiting and possibly leverage outside relationships as well. The couple other trends we're seeing in the marketplace is the this emergence more readily of people using forgivable financing. I think a lot of the firms that were really aggressive about in the marketplace have rethought that strategy. We're seeing firms come back in line with less irrational exuberance, to quote Mr. Greenspan, in terms of what they're providing for forgivable financing for their reps. They're starting to align the compensation with the profitability characteristics and wants and needs of the broker-dealers. So what we're starting to see within the independent broker-dealer community is people having asset conversion bonuses in place. We're starting to see having longevity bonuses in place as well. This ensures that the advisor is aligned with the ultimate going concern success of the broker-dealer. In the past, I'll get to you in a second, Larry. In the past, what we were seeing is the only person that won was the representative. The clients, in some ways, are harmed by the migration for financing. The broker-dealers anticipated somewhere between a 20 to 25% growth rate on this advisor's business, so firms were investing a significant amount of financing on the front end, knowing that they were going to participate in future revenues unfettered by the amortization of that forgivable loans, which seemed like a good idea when the markets were growing and revenue were growing at 20 to 25%. But as we came through the markets we just came through, it didn't work out quite as well. Larry?
So you risk the independent status of a broker if you give him a forgivable loan? How do you do that to somebody who's not an employee?
Jim Nightingast? In effect, how we do it is it's a draw on future commissions. So we provide a transition note made out to an advisor. That transition note expects that the advisor is going to perform to some level of revenue over a period of time, and based on those numbers, we'll forgive a certain amount of that forgivable note. Some firms are starting to have two different agreements. They'll have a general obligation, a note to that that the representative signs and executes for that firm, and then separately there will be a forgivable schedule associated with that. So they're two separate and unique documents, and I think we're going to see some more of that within the marketplace. But we haven't seen it get challenged or become a challenge within IRS tax code or interpretation for independent contractor versus common law versus statutory employee. Correct. Is there any, and this is interactive. I did want to share that with you on the front end. There's a lot of intellectual capital in this audience. We're by far not the only subject matter experts here. This is an educational session, so if you have something to add, raise your hand. We'll call on you. All we ask is that you state your name and your firm and your question, and or perspective that you want the audience to know or share. We certainly appreciate that. We're just not up here talking for an hour and a half. Jim?
One of the things we did is we went to a separate note and a separate bonus, so that it's not a true forgivable loan. It's two separate documents. We're concerned about tax implications and this potentially being challenged. So we've separated them out, so it's a separate note. And then there's a bonus agreement, which will sort of match your forgivable status. We think that offers protection if the IRS would come in and challenge the nature of these forgivable loans, that they be deemed income in the year that they're issued. So that's a strategy we take, and I think everybody should take a look at how they structure these and really go back to their accountants and legal departments.
Those of you that are recruiting in the wirehouse space today, if you get those documents from the advisors, they tend to have the same structure. There's two different documents in place. One of them is the promissory note. One of them is the bonus forgivable schedule associated with it. Some of the, many may have read the letter that came out from Mary Shapiro that said, we're monitoring this in the marketplace. I don't know that it really applies to what a lot of the independent broker-dealers were doing. It's many of the broker-dealers that we come across in the marketplace tend to have a forgivable feature that's got a pro rata piece to it. So it's not cliff vested. I think where the regulators are concerned is that you have an advisor who might be on the cusp of getting meet the benchmark for forgiveness, and they push that last piece of business through, or they sell a higher commission product to satisfy the terms of that forgivable note, and it's not necessarily the best product or solution for the client. If you have a pro rata forgiveness feature to your note, meaning that if my criteria in year one is that the advisor does $100,000 in production to receive one-third, one-fifth, one-seventh forgiveness, whatever your note structure is, if you give them partial credit, meaning they've only did $80,000, so they get 80% of one-seventh, one-fifth, one-third of forgiveness in that year, I think you mitigate some of the risk and exposure you have from a regulator's perspective. And I see that as a kind of emerging best practice that I would encourage you to follow. Mary, you have anything you want to add or share on that
point? No, but I do think that it is becoming a little bit less important with the upfront fees. I think really what's really critical is that it's a good fit for the group or the advisor, and how you recruit them from the onset is also really critical.
It's, and we'll talk a little bit about compensation, but it's becoming increasingly more important, I think, as advisors look at the investment you're making in their transition, but also that you have some consideration for the profitability characteristics and some of the regulatory commentary on how forgivable loans are if you're using those in your organization today. Another thing we see, and I know Jim and I used to work together at Securities America, we would do is there's some organizations will create advisor loans that are completely repayable, and they do it through a commission reduction process. The risk to you as the organization is the advisor doesn't produce the amount of money that you're retaining to pay back the loan isn't there. So think through that if you're doing that as well. Some of the other pieces that we see as it relates to trends in the marketplace is advisory headcount. This has been a precipitous decline in the marketplace over the past 4 to 5 years, really several years before that. We've seen about a 17% decline from 2004 to 2009. We're sitting at about 301 full-time professionals within the marketplace. We're ending 2009 with just about 250,000. Now, FINRA shows a lot more registered people in the marketplace. I think there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 600,000 plus registered professionals. This is specific to the individuals that are in producers. Full-time production producers. The of that 250,000, the independent broker-dealer community is the largest. There's approximately 109, and this data sort of shifts a little bit from time to time. But there's about 109,000 independent contractors within the independent broker-dealer community. This number's somewhat inflated. A lot of career insurers moved to an independent platform, inflating some of this number slightly. In the marketplaces, they adopted independent broker-dealer platforms. There are several firms out there that have done that over the past couple years. Nonetheless, this trend towards independence is going to continue in the marketplace. We see within the insurers and the national and regional wires somewhere in the neighborhood of 60,000 advisors apiece. The challenge that we see from a recruiting perspective, as I mentioned earlier, the recruiting is the number one growth lever for a lot of independent broker-dealers. If you are investing in organic growth within their organizations, they think they can go out and grab market share and new revenue through inorganic growth. This population shrinking, that trend's real, it's also aging. If you look out in the marketplace, the majority of the advisors started in the industry in the 70s, that's about 35% of the population. The 10% of the advisors started in the 2000s. So we don't have a good system for replacing these advisors in the marketplace. We think that we're not going to have an industry shortfall. We think that a lot of the training is being done in the home offices. We're going to see some trends emerge in the marketplace where we have more direct-to-consumer, direct brokerage relationships similar to the Schwabs, the TD Waterhouses of the world, ING Direct. This will become the fuel, if you will, for the next generation of independent advisors in the marketplace. Your success will be contingent on your ability to help plug those individuals into your organization and specifically into branch relationships. And again, we'll talk a little bit about that as we talk about how to build out your recruiting strategy. But intrinsic to that approach is you're creating succession in your model, you're creating retention within your larger branches. But you have to have the facility to both train, onboard, and help those individuals be successful in your organization. And if you look out across our industry, and you sort of survey your own rep population or the industry population, one of the areas that we really haven't done well as an industry is professional development of our experienced advisors. We do a really good job at introducing product concepts and marketing ideas around product to our advisors, but we don't do a really good job at training them how to sell in the marketplace. And this, I think, is a significant opportunity for those firms looking to differentiate themselves.
One thing I wanted to add is one of our figures there is that there's 12% of investment professionals that produce in excess of 500,000. So, you know, that's 30,000 advisors out there that are on the higher end of production. And those are also probably your senior advisors, your a little bit older advisors, and this is a great opportunity to develop a mentorship program with those advisors, bringing in the younger generation, bringing in their children or anyone that they want to kind of get into the business with them, and that also will help with their succession planning and selling their business.
I agree, and it's also from a perspective that if you ask most broker-dealers who their ideal candidate is, it's that $500,000 producer. You sort of hear that randomly throughout the marketplace. I think it's everybody's ideal prospect, but it's a very limited pool of individuals. And most of those producers, when they get to that level, tend to become satisfied and more difficult to displace from a recruiting perspective. The majority of our industry sits in that under 75,000 category. This is where the opportunity to consolidate, bring these individuals together, and create both value to your existing branch as well as value to these advisors exist. The ideal profile in most organizations in terms of profitability, though, tends to exist in that $100,000 to $250,000 producer. And you see a lot of firms articulate what their benchmark is in terms of who they'll recruit to the organization by way of the trailing 12 months in those same categories. The trend, right, is that we're not training these advisors in the marketplace. This is real. These trends are mostly a function of the margin compression. If you look back, 10, 20, 15 years ago, a lot of organizations were putting a lot of money into new advisor development. The margins that afforded them the ability to invest in new advisor development are eroding. They're eroding rapidly. I think they're going to erode even more in this current administration. We have an administration that tends to be more consumer-friendly, and we'll see more pricing pressure and transparency on products, eliminating and eroding even more of that margin that was used to fund these types of programs. So again, speaking to the opportunity, I think, from a growth perspective, are those independent firms that encourage advisor development underneath their existing branches that will in turn create some retention and profitability metrics for your organization. These trends are secular. As I mentioned earlier, that trend where the advisory fee went from 111 to 90 basis points, that doesn't reverse itself. It's not cyclical. It doesn't correlate with the markets. We know this is real. We know that regulatory reform is real. It's going to occur. We have yet to, I think, experience the true impact it's going to have on our organization. We know there's a high degree of correlation between the S&P and customer complaints in a very inverse relationship, meaning as the markets go up, complaints go down. As the market go down, complaints go up. But it takes a couple years for us to truly see the impact in terms of our regulatory reform, policy change, and some of the supervisory structure and expense associated with that we'll have within our broker-dealers. Mary, you have anything to add on some of the observations from an insider perspective?
What I'm finding out there as I'm recruiting reps is that there are more and more reps that are just open to talking. Particularly the reps from the larger wirehouses, they don't feel as safe, I guess, in their brand as they did. So we're definitely opening more dialogue with some wirehouse reps.
The good news is, right, from a recruiting perspective, there's a lot of experienced advisors out there still to recruit today. The bad news is, as I mentioned already, we have a shrinking population. Depending on the surveys that you review and study, the aggregate recruiting objectives of firms with a publicly stated recruiting goal can be anywhere from 10,000 to 42,000 advisors in any given year. The same survey suggests that the number of advisors looking to make a change is anywhere from 10,000 to 25,000. So depending on who you look at, who you believe, what's certainly in place is there's a supply and demand gap. This is going to put more pressure on broker-dealers to grow, who are looking to grow just through inorganic growth and specifically recruiting, especially when we're all going after the same marketplace that tends to be shrinking. It's also going to create, I think, a situation where the acquisition cost is going to increase significantly. So really, as we sequence into the next part of this presentation, it's what are market leaders that we've observed out there doing to differentiate themselves, and how specifically do you become that individual's broker-dealer of choice? We think it starts really with understanding why advisors make a change and leave one broker-dealer to affiliate with the next. Despite sort of common belief in the marketplace, it's not payout, it's not always compensation. Mm-mm. In fact, if you look at the surveys, again, there's multiple surveys out there, and sometimes they contradict each other, but we try to take a consensus view. On a 10-point scale, compensation and payout ranks anywhere from 4 to 7 in terms of importance. And it's become increasingly more important in the absence of value. So compensation's important, but if you're doing things for your advisor that they value in their organization, payout's not going to be as significant in the marketplace. We also know that advisors are generally content, and they get caught up in sort of the inertia of their practice. So if you're getting 80% of the value proposition, 80% of your service proposition directionally correct, you're most likely going to retain that advisor in your broker-dealer. We segment the dissatisfaction in two different categories. They're sort of systemic issues. These are things that the advisor perceives in their environment that specifically impact them and their business. It doesn't necessarily affect the entire organization. This is dissatisfaction with the overall broker-dealer value proposition. Again, the value proposition becomes critical and a great deal of influence on your payout if it's absent, or the advisor has outgrown that value proposition. The other systemic is dissatisfaction with the broker-dealer business model. So if your model is primarily commission-based or product-oriented, proprietary product-oriented, and you have an advisor who wants to move to providing advice, and your model doesn't support the advice model, you're going to have a systemic issue with that advisor specifically. Doesn't mean it affects the entire population of your advisors, but for that individual, your model no longer fits that individual. Shift in the direction of the advisor's business. So this might be where an advisor is moving off a certain type of product and wants to engage in Reg D offerings or some other type of alternative investments, and you just don't have the systems, supervisory structure, or due diligence methodology within your organization to support that. This is going to influence advisor dissatisfaction. Again, it's not at a firm level. It's systemic. You don't have to meet or score in the 90th percentile in all these areas. You just have to have it directionally correct with the overall population of your advisors. Non-systemic issues that affect the entire organization, both the broker-dealer, the management team, its advisors, and its clients, are mergers and acquisitions. We saw some of this in 2007. We saw it in 2008. A great example would be the Advest and Merrill Lynch merger. That was a disaster, right? It affected everybody, including the clients. That's a non-systemic issue, not advisor-related, but something that affected all parts of the organization. Change in the management of a broker-dealer. This is even more significant in terms of crisis. So organizations that are taking long-standing leadership, changing that leadership in periods of crisis sends a message to the marketplace. It sends a message to your advisors and affects all parts of the organization. Operational mistakes or problems, technology disruption. If your technology shuts down for 5 days, that affects your employees, your brand, your reputation, the consumers, and the advisor servicing those consumers.
And Chris, what I hear out there is from reps that I'm trying to recruit is really service level and leadership in the organization as really key factors in why they'd want to make a change.
Specifically, when you talk about leadership, can you give some examples of where that affects?
Well, the you know, everything from the CEO to the national sales manager, you know, how supportive they are of the sales force.
Access to management is critical. Mm-hmm. I think Mary's saying here, if you have a process that it sort of insulates your field force from your leadership team. That can be problematic. Advisors like to feel like they have some connective tissue, connective tissue back to the organization and its leadership team, the individuals that are responsible for making the decisions that affect their organization. That really gets down to the cultural attributes of your organization. And as that starts to change through a not well-managed M&A activity in the marketplace, it creates significant disruption for the advisors and their clients.
Chris?
Yes.
Conspicuously absent on that list is anything that seems to be directly related to marketing. If you're in the marketing track, I mean, what type of feedback or information do you get about the importance of those types of services or in relation to some of these other items?
There's two different types of marketing, I think, from the advisor's perspective. There's product marketing, so those ideas that help them introduce different product solutions to their clients. And I think as an industry, we do really well there. We've outsourced that for the most part to product relationships that we have within the organization. Some companies that have done a really good job at creating investment advisory platforms or sleeves within their organization have created some business consultants that go out there and introduce and help that advisor sell those solutions to their clients. I think on the flip side, where we haven't done well, as I mentioned earlier, is helping that advisor individually from an educational perspective differentiate themselves in the marketplace, how to introduce financial planning, sort of the practice management aspects that were spoken to in the last presentation. As an industry, we just haven't met the advisor's needs there. If they were grading us, we would probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of a D as an industry. So from a marketing support, how do I get my name out there? How do I create some brand awareness, aided awareness in the marketplace? We can certainly do better. And those firms that are able to bring that to the advisor relationship, I think, will differentiate themselves against their peers. That answer your question, Terry? Is it? Mary, would you have anything to add there from
we're gonna get a little bit more into that too, Terry, as we go along, the marketing aspect.
The six areas that we see in the majority on any value proposition really begin with the brand. And from an academic perspective, your brand is the product and service that you're presenting to the marketplace. It's your name and it's a concept you apply, and we don't have to look too far to see firms that have done a really good job at differentiating themselves in the marketplace, whether it's we're the financial planning firm, we're the business development experts, we're the fee-based experts, we're a technology company. Firms have differentiated themselves on a concept, and then that concept is associated with their name. Depth of capabilities is critical in the marketplace. So what is it your firm does? How do you add value to that relationship, and how well do you do it? So whether it's technology, whether it's marketing support, to Terry's point, whether it's educational, professional development, practice management, those are the capabilities of your firm, and your ability to wrap that well in a very concise, articulate message, I think, is going to be critical in your ability to face off in the marketplace, and even more critical as you go to market and try to capture some of the breakaway broker opportunity that exists within our industry. The type of clients you serve. We're not going to name any firms here, but there are firms in the marketplace who have been less selective on who they brought into their broker-dealer, and they've been largely defined in the industry by the type of advisors that they've attracted, good and bad. And I think the firm and its reputation is often as deep as its advisor force, so the type of clients being the advisor in this scenario, are critical in how you differentiate yourself and you face off in the marketplace with your value proposition. Compensation, as I mentioned, is important. Compensation is increasingly more important in the absence of value. So if you're an organization that's providing a great deal of brand and marketing support, you can take a little bit more of the advisor's compensation. If you're providing qualified leads and market access or client acquisition opportunities for your advisor, you can take more of their compensation because they value what you're doing in the marketplace. If you look at some of the best structured, most valuable OSJ branch relationships in the marketplace, they have a hub and spoke model. They're creating leads for the advisor, the that's affiliated with their organization, and they have a very deep, meaningful relationship with their advisors and a great deal of retention. As your organization goes out into the marketplace, your ability to capitalize on your brand and your advisors, if you can create market access, whether it be through a credit union, a bank, some unique marketing idea that your advisors have, that's a very meaningful way to differentiate yourself amongst your competitors. Practice ownership is going to be critical here. Can the advisor participate and own their business? Can they build goodwill in the brand? Some organizations allow this, some organizations don't. I think it's a critical component of any value proposition going forward. And your ability to help them monetize that practice equity that they've created in their organization, whether it's through a practice transfer program or helping them package that organization for sale to an outside organization. It's certainly something you'd want to have in your portfolio of value, if you will, with any prospective or existing representative affiliated with your organization. And lastly is ego gratification. Advisors want to perceive a sense of importance and value not only to their clients but to your organization. So your ability to, through rewards and recognition, identify these individuals and hold them up in your organization, I think is critical. Whether that's through an advisory panel or nominating your staff for an advisory panel or putting them on your platform at national regional events, this is important to the advisor and should be part of any organization's value proposition. Mary, you want to spend a few minutes talking about how we define our ideal prospect?
Sure. To Chris's point on our last slide, the value proposition component is if you don't know what value you bring and what your story is to tell, you can't go after the right person. And we were talking about this earlier. I mean, you can call 100 reps or advisors, and there may be only 3 that will fit your profile. But you have to know what it is. It has to be very clearly defined. And you have to have a plan on how you're going to go after these people. A little bit on brand awareness. Have you all seen the commercials for Ally Bank on TV? They're building a pretty good brand for that bank. That bank is owned by GMAC, and they're headquartered in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I am. But that's just an idea of how they get that word out. You know, do you want a pony? Do you want a pony with the 2 little girls? And that's just something. It's very memorable. But as far as type of platform for financial services sector that would best align with your organization, you know, what is your footprint? Are you national, regional? Are you independent contractor or employee? Do you have, you know, real estate availability? Do you have open architecture for product solutions? And if that's important to them, that is really key. An investment advisor platform is obviously, as you know, very key right now. And if they can have practice ownership. And like I said before, I don't think payout is real critical, especially with what we've been through with the economy. I think that they have got to feel surrounded. They have to feel supported. They have to feel supported for their staff. And it's, again, they're open to hearing about new opportunities, and they're really ready to listen.
I think another critical component of how you identify your ideal prospect is your supervisory structure. I know this is a marketing track. We're not supposed to spend too much time on compliance, but if your supervisory structure doesn't support the type of advisor you're trying to attract to your organization, this can become problematic for you over time as your organization grows. It can also become impactful in terms of the operating costs that your company will inherit over time.
True.
So the litmus test, I think, for each year as you're going out in the marketplace and trying to determine who your ideal profile is does your organization support that type of prospect? Make sure you have alignment in the infrastructure to onboard that candidate and ensure them a successful transition and experience within your respective broker-dealers. We're going to move to how you attract prospects in the marketplace. Mary's going to spend a little time here with you from a third-party recruiting perspective on how you enhance your profile and you attract the right type of individuals to your organization.
As far as enhancing your public profile, this kind of goes back to brand, but develop a really good advertising campaign. And you can do this with many different budgets. Get involved in industry events such as FSI. Contribute to articles. We have Investment News here and some other publications. It's very important to get exposure through that. Get to know your editors. That's very key. Another thing is to develop and implement a really strong PR initiative, and you can do this most effectively by communicating this to every employee in your firm, and really so it gravitates, you know, up and down. Getting involved locally and nationally is very important. Get involved with charities. That is, again, more to strengthen your brand. Anything else you can think of there?
I think what's critical here, and we're going to go into each one of these areas in a little more depth, is be consistent, committed to whatever you're doing.
True.
A lot of organizations start and stop because they don't recognize an immediate result. The other thing I would add here, if you can't measure it, don't do it.
Good point.
And give yourself a very specific time period that you're using to evaluate it. I think we've probably all heard that, the SMART acronym. I try to apply it to any recruiting initiative we have in the organization. And for those of you that haven't heard it, it's specific, measurable, achievable, results-oriented, and time-bound. That's what SMART stands for. I think if you apply this to any advertising, marketing, recruiting strategy in your organization, you'll find yourself successful if it's got the right ingredients to it.
What are some things that you all do as far as getting your name out there in the public? Anybody have any thoughts that weren't suggested? No?
Well, one of the things, Mary, I'll throw out is recruiting just isn't one department in the organization. It's got to be everybody.
You are right on. It's got to be everybody. Everybody has to have the buy-in. Everybody needs to know that's what signs their paychecks.
We're going to spend a little bit of time as we talk about recruiting infrastructure, the importance of onboarding and appointing champions within the organization,
mm-hmm.
as to to making an impactful and meaningful recruiting story with your company. Advertising and branding is going to be critical, as Mary mentioned, to any organization. Basically, your brand, your visual image wants to support the essence of who you are in the marketplace. It's got to be some consistency in terms of your signage, your color, how you face off with prospective representatives. You want to craft the message that's going to attract and gain the attention of your prospective audience, that ideal profile that we spoke about. And you want to commit to an extended period of time. As I mentioned already, there's many organizations that don't see an immediate result, and they pull back. Yes.
I don't know if you were there yet, but could you talk about developing a media kit for your program?
Yeah. What I mean by this is there are a lot of opportunities for free public or free press within the marketplace with industry publications. So much the way some companies will create a list of speakers for a speakers bureau, I encourage people to do this for their broker-dealer. So you have subject matter experts within your organization, profile those individuals in a format that you can share with different industry publications. Use the same piece for industry opinion leaders within the marketplace. You want them to tell your story for you. I think that's an opportunity.
And you can do this locally, nationally, regionally?
Correct. It's just how you communicate your story to people that might champion that story for you in the marketplace. Anybody do anything like that within their companies? Jim, anything you want to share there?
Well, it's the media doesn't know who you are or what brand you're trying to promote.
There's not to be confused with a broker-dealer information kit or recruiting kit. Right? This is talking about your organization, what its value proposition is, what you do well, what you don't do well. It's sort of the demographics of your organization and identifies your executive management team and your subject matter experts within that organization. I think a company that does this well, I don't know if this is their intent behind it, Commonwealth sends out the Commonwealth Business Review. And in their features, the subject matter experts is a contributor to that magazine that they send out. It can also become a tool to for publishers to engage with those individuals as subject matter experts for those topics.
So that media kit, think of your recruitment point of view, add the industry journalists, think of them as prospective recruit to your firm. Everything that you would do to inform and report a prospect due to the journalists in the industry. Because you're looking for top of mind with the recruit, you're looking for top of mind with the journalists. The information that you would provide is talking to a person, a specialist who's good at what. They're always looking for good story ideas, they're always looking for the right people, and it's more sweat equity on the PR side. The media kit just puts together who your troops are for certain things.
Another thing to add to that is if you are involved or you should be involved in local charities or Habitat for Humanity, that's all really good things to add to your media kit as well to get some more exposure. Yes? Right.
Mm-hmm. We get hit with a lot of pitches, and a lot of them just go in this year and go out the other. So
what could you give examples of something that would, you know, that where we'd grab you?
Well, you know, so I think Chris just mentioned something about Commonwealth. I mean, they have a publication, and we get hit with so much stuff. I mean, I don't have time to look at all this stuff. But they have a very good publication that comes out. However often, I don't know. I mean, I stumble upon it once in a while. But they have good sources from their people who hit upon timely issues in the industry. And I'll see a headline, I say, well, that's interesting. And I'll read what this person from Commonwealth has to say. Like, that's a good source for a story. And I know that I wind up using Commonwealth for sources a decent amount of time because they just present themselves and present issues. And people can talk about those issues well in a very compelling way. And I'm not going to say I use them that much, but in a relative sense, I find myself using them I don't want to call Commonwealth because I use them too much. I wanted to get fresh voices in my stories. So I always am open to
so there's an opportunity.
And new people and new ideas. But there's got to be a reason for me to call these particular people and partners.
What I've found to be critical in those situations is it can't be a pump and dump on your story. When these journalists are contacting you for a perspective, they want an industry perspective, and your brand is sort of a passive message within the organization or within the print. There's a lot of individuals out there that will try to get their story across and apply it to an industry article when it just really doesn't fit, and oftentimes you'll get one or two lines at best quoted and not certainly what you intended to in that particular article or story. How many are knowledgeable of the editorial calendar that the financial services publications publish on an annual basis? If you're not aware of that today, I would certainly encourage you to make that as part of your planning. In each plan year, most of these publications create an editorial calendar so you know what stories they're doing on a year in advance almost. Jeff, any comments you provide there on that?
Try to pitch at least 2 or 3 months in advance. Sometimes we get calls from people, hey, I see you're doing a story for the February issue on something.
In 2 weeks.
Well, yeah, we can sort of put that to bed already. So really, at least 2 months, sometimes maybe 3 months in advance. That might be a little too much time because sometimes I get calls from PR firms at firms, or the PR person at a firm say, hey, I see you're doing a story, we have a source. That's a little too far in advance. So maybe 2 months in advance is a good time to reach out to us and other publishers.
Oh, that's excellent information.
Sort of on the same concept of the media kit, one of the things that we do is create a profile of our branch leaders in the marketplace. So as we're working with third-party relationships, they know exactly who to contact. They know the value proposition of that organization. They know what type of candidate would best fit their company. whether it be an independent affiliation or a Lincoln-branded opportunity, they know exactly who to contact, and we allow those individuals to go direct to those relationships within our recruiting strategy. I'll take the next slide.
Our next slide is hosting information sessions about your firm. And this is this one where we're first, what are we referring to here? When they're,
in effect, what we're speaking to here is how do you
create some
awareness within your marketplace. So what we think is a best practice, some firms do it well, is taking an information or a component of your value proposition and having a senior executive present that to the marketplace, inviting individuals to participate on that call, inviting individuals to participate in a workshop or a forum. It might be best practices on branch building. It might be how to acquire new client relationships. It may be how to leverage a web marketing strategy in your communication strategy, how to develop public relations. Whatever your firm does well, highlight these things within your prospective community, and also invite some of your existing representatives to participate.
So they can help tell the story.
They can tell the story, and most advisors look to that peer network for confirmation of the value proposition that you're trying to face off and communicate to the marketplace.
And set this up as your reps would set up a seminar, invitation only, have them RSVP, you know, follow up with the people that are coming to prepare them, and then also in follow-up after the seminar is you can follow up with people that didn't attend and you know, get additional information to the people that did attend that they requested.
What I would say is really meaningful to the prospective audience is having the individual given that presentation to reach out to that candidate who's RSVP'd, tell them they look forward to seeing them at the event. You're going to see your attendance significantly pick up. There's most industry professionals are extremely busy. Something comes up at the last minute, I think, in all of our days, and it's really easy to dismiss something that I just RSVP'd for. It's more difficult to dismiss that if you've called me on the phone and you say, gosh, Eric, I'm really looking forward to seeing you today. I'm glad you're here, and look forward to your participation in our event. There's a meaningful connection that occurred there, and then you want to follow up on that connection going forward. If they missed your presentation, offer, if you think it's the type of candidate that you want to attract to your organization, offer to go through that information individually with that individual over the phone, or have a follow-up session that you do over the telephone or some kind of webcasting medium. The other best practice that we've seen, if you're doing a presentation in front of an audience like this, is have some type of teaser piece and then a more meaningful follow-up piece in exchange for their information. Give them a reason to want to have a conversation with you prospectively after the event that you've hosted, whether that be a telephone, web conference, or an in-person event.
Then you can follow up with, there are a couple of different ways you can follow up with your prospects. You can send out cold call letters to individuals that you've identified that you want to target. And this needs to be just a one page, probably three paragraph letter that introduces your firm, the purpose of the purpose that you're writing, and should end with an express for desire to meet them to set up a personal appointment. And your follow-up letters, you can remind the candidate where you were introduced and where you met and explain why you're interested in speaking with them further, address any concerns that they have indicated to you previously one by one, and that makes them feel important. It makes them feel like that you're handling their particular concerns. Provide one or two relevant reasons why you think it might be in your mutual interest to further discuss these opportunities. And then also, it's really good to write just a handwritten note at the bottom of the letter because that's always read. Anything else you can think of?
I would just add, one of the ways have found success in recruiting is taking different industry studies, highlighting what's applicable to that advisor in the practice, and then having some meaningful dialogue with that advisor around that study. Whether it's, it can be a variety of things. It might be something that National Financial produces, a broker-dealer sentiment. I've taken that study, highlighted different parts of that, and then try to take some of the concepts that were explored in that sentiment and apply it to how we could create a solution for that advisor. There's many different white papers in the industry. Your organization may publish a white paper. Take that white paper, personalize it with some highlights and a personal note, whether it be handwritten or typewritten, on how that applies to them and their practice, and ask for some time one-on-one to go through it with them.
A drip campaign, which I'm certain that most of us do, is just establish types of communications you want to send out to the prospective advisors on a continual basis. You don't want to flood them with information, but you just want to just drip on them. And in between the email or direct mail or webinar communication, you know, be certain to contact them by phone and ask them if there's anything else you can do to help them, or anything else you can, any other additional information you can get to them. Probably no more than monthly as far as your communication. And also, if you have a newsletter, quarterly or a semi-annual newsletter, you can include them on that distribution list. Anyone else have any ideas on, you know, what you do for your drip campaigns on an ongoing basis?
My only comment on drip campaigns is they can become a nuisance. And
yeah, it can't be too much.
They can be very costly, and there's a low response rate to it. If you use drip mail, drip email, I would encourage you to have some level of coordination across the different pieces, with your print advertisement to your email advertisement to your direct mail advertisement. Create a theme and follow through with that theme throughout whatever the campaign period is. Personally, no more than every other month, and I think it's going to be content dependent. So if it's just an HTML or text blast on, you know, call us and learn more about X, Y, and Z in our BD, I don't think it's as meaningful. If you're able to create an e-zine with some practice management content, there tends to be a high degree of receptivity to that information, but it's got to be differentiated. Everybody's doing that in the marketplace. Create a subscriber base to it, and build off that. Any thoughts or feedback or comments on that? How many of you use email in the you guys found it effective, ineffective?
Pretty effective.
Pretty effective?
It's cheap.
Very cheap. It's also very easy to delete. So that's why I say the content's gotta be meaningful to the advisor. Who's receiving that particular content. Good point. Best practice we talk about, and I think this is consistent with what I just said to you, is provide some thought leadership in your messaging, and then always drive the recipient back to where they can get more information about your company. Make it easy for them to learn more about who you are, whether it be through click-throughs medium, whether, you know, be just a direct number, easy for them to find. I've seen a lot of email solicitations where I can't find how I contact the individual. And all product lines, not just specific to the industry, but something might pique my interest, whether it's something from NordicTrack or you know, something from a winery that I subscribe to. If it's difficult for me to get the information I'm looking for to make contact, I quickly delete that message and go on. So
a couple other things on this. Again, a handwritten note to their home would be, I think, really nice, you know, 2-3 times a year. And also leave a voicemail. If they don't have their phone forwarded to their cell phone, you can leave a voicemail after business hours, and they just hear your voice, they make the connection again, and it's non-threatening.
Marketing.
you're not going to be successful executing a recruiting initiative with a drip campaign. It's going to create aided awareness at best. So if one of your staff picks up the phone and contacts that advisor, they may have some recall on your brand and your messaging. If that individual sees some print in the marketplace, they might make some correlation to an email that they received or a direct mail they received. Matt just sent me a football, and I associate that football with First Allied in their campaign. I can tell you everything about it, right? If I were interested in the organization, I'd be able to associate the messaging that Matt was trying to communicate through his campaign with First Allied. So you want to create some cognitive association with what you're doing in your campaign strategy, but realize it may not. You may not realize the benefit of that to some point in the future. Information kit and website?
You can talk about that.
Okay. This really is how you communicate your value proposition and story to your prospective representatives. This doesn't need to be an exhaustive replay of everything you do in your organization. You should modularize this information into the 4 to 6 components that complement your value proposition. Make it very concise. You don't want your recipient to learn everything about you in that recruiting kit. You want to tease them. You want to give them enough information to encourage them to contact you for more information and possibly come visit your company. The recruiting kit or information kit should create a general awareness of your organization. It should be complementary with your website. It should, again, match some of your print and other campaigns that you're doing in the marketplace. If you have content that's relevant to your organization from a press release, we encourage you to put that information in the recruiting kit. If you're contributing to different articles, we encourage you to put that information in the recruiting kit. You can drive back in a very cost-effective way individuals to your website. I know some firms spend a lot of money creating a CD. Very little return on those from a marketplace perspective. A lot of people never put that CD into the computer. They're going out to your website first and foremost to look at you. So as much as you can, drive individuals to your website and make sure that information is consistent with your content and presentation in the marketplace. You might also consider an e-brochure. There's a lot of great technology out there that's better than Flash now. Where somebody can flip through your product or information kit electronically in a very user-friendly format, but make sure you have the ability for them to print off the pieces that they want to print off. Not everybody likes to read information electronically. From a any questions, anything anybody else would add that they're doing different in the marketplace around creating just some awareness of their brand with prospective representatives that they found beneficial or?
Chris, I've got a question. My name is Greg Gunderson. I'm the CEO of Investment Centers of America in Bismarck, North Dakota. The
warm part of the country these days.
30 below yesterday. Boomer Advisor Magazine ranked us the top mid-tier broker dealer, which means our reps went in and voted for that. And the nice part was I didn't even know about it. We didn't orchestrate a campaign to make that happen. But in reality, truth over harmony, how do prospects look at broker-dealer of the year, top-end-tier broker-dealer, those type of drift pieces that are in national magazines?
I'd really ask the audience that question. My personal thoughts on it are I do think it has meaning to prospective representatives. It creates some general awareness of your company. It certainly communicates that there's a service and culture there that the representatives that are affiliated with your organization appreciate. It's how you tie that into your overall marketing and recruiting campaign. I think that's critical on a go-forward basis. How do you use that information? Eric, I appreciate yours or Jim's perspective. You've certainly been a recipient of that many, many times.
Well, I think any good PR is good PR. And PR is how you build a brand. But they always say, you build a brand with PR and you will maintain it with advertising. Of course, PR is a lot cheaper in this case. It would be free. So certainly, I would think that all firms would be wanting to figure out how to get more PR and winning an award, some third party saying you're good rather than
Great. Anybody?
But at that point, would you rather be, working with somebody that has success than somebody else, supposedly a third party, has pointed to and said, this is a successful organization, or do you want to go to somebody that you really don't know a whole lot about? So as much as you can use that in your branding campaigns and marketing campaigns, and yes, we were voted this, this, and this. Those are things, but you have to make it real for the individual as well. How are you then going to use that in your unique value proposition to reach that ideal of buyer?
Correct.
That can contribute to further success in that area.
Yeah, that particular award combines a equivalent of a testimonial, because it's your advisors that voted for you, but because it's a third party that's putting the survey out, it adds credibility versus you pick your 10 reps likely the most and quote them. So I think that particular one is pretty powerful. Obviously, a lot of firms have won it. There's four different categories, and it comes out every year, so some advisors might be a little intimidated by it, but I think overall, those kind of things are very valuable. You see some of our clever competitors, usually larger firms, creating their own surveys. You hire somebody to do a survey on you that shows that how wonderful you are. Well, we may laugh at it, but that's what branding's all about. Finding ways to give the credibility to the statements you're making. We've done internal surveys. We've done a survey of our advisors for the last 12 years where they rate us overall. That's not as good as the outside one, but it's still better than saying we think we're really good. So yeah, I think that's, all that stuff is good.
Right. And again, it just really gets to how you take that recognition and get that information into the hands of your prospective audience. I think it has a great deal of meaning to advisors that are looking at transitioning away from the wirehouse community. They don't know who you are. Service is extremely important to them. Culture is extremely important to them. And to Eric's point, that is an implied testimony in that recognition and reward. So certainly leverage it where you can. Our next section really deals with, once you've created some awareness in your marketplace, you've identified your ideal prospect, how do you structure your recruiting team? And there's all different recipes out there in the marketplace. I think that the success is largely dictated by the type of platform that you have. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time exploring the different platforms as I see them, as an executive in charge of recruiting strategy for a multiple affiliation model in the marketplace, and then Mary's going to share some perspective as a third-party recruiter operating independently in the marketplace. The first is really an insourced recruiting initiative. Most firms, as they're starting to embark upon a recruiting strategy, identify one individual in the organization that's a great steward of the information, enthusiastic about the company, to go out and share that message with prospective representatives. It tends to be a more passive strategy, meaning as individuals reach into the firm, contact them, and want more information about the company, as a result of a message that they read or an advisor testimony or a referral from an existing advisor, that information sort of communicates, that individual sort of communicates the information. Many firms started out this way from a recruiting perspective. Over time, these relationships evolve and grow, and you start to build out multiple recruiters within your organization. There's some firms out there that have outsourced recruiting completely, meaning that they use firms for retainer, and they put these firms out there to go out and identify prospective representatives for their organization and recruit to them. I think this has some pluses and minuses. It can certainly be variabilized the costs associated with it, but over time can become very expensive, and I think you lose some continuity of the message when you have somebody outside the organization representing completely your story. So what we found to be more successful, and we'll talk a little bit about it, is a combination of the two. There's individuals that have a centralized recruiting structure. That means all your staff are centralized in one location. You don't have them decentralized in different markets throughout the country. Conversely, there's some organizations that have decentralized staff. This has some pros and cons to it. I think the benefit of having a centralized recruiting model is you can inspect what you expect more easily as a recruiting manager or as the president of a broker-dealer with a recruiting team assigned to you. You can monitor the activities, and you know your individuals out there in the marketplace working more diligently to share your story. The the downside of that is you can't necessarily get to that market where a prospective representative is as quickly as some of your competitor firms that may already be in that market or have a decentralized model in place. LPL, I think, probably got the most expansive recruiting team in the marketplace. They, I think, get in front of a prospect within 24 to 48 hours because they're so dispersed amongst amongst the geography that they cover and are trying to recruit to. So pros and cons to each model. I think you have to look at what your operating budget is for your recruiting staff and make that determination. I also believe that you can take a hybrid approach to them where you have a centralized internal team focused on very specific projects, and then you can use decentralized remote teams similar to what Mary's firm does on a retained basis to focus on a larger geography. The hybrid approach, for example, we use inside Lincoln. I have a national team of recruiters. Those national recruiters are responsible for a large geography, meaning they manage a relationship with multiple relationships, whether it be third-party recruiters, branch managers, wholesalers. Their job is to penetrate that particular market with the Lincoln story. However, I don't have them focused on all 5, 10, 15, whatever states they're assigned. I have them focus on very specific market opportunities. So, for example, if St. Louis is a strategic market to me, they have a project that will span anywhere from 90 to 180 days in that specific market where they're assigned a budget, resources, and third-party relationships for them to accomplish that particular goal. Separately, we wrap our recruiting strategy with retained relationships. And the job of the retained relationship is to go out and support our field leadership, whether it's our independent branch managers or our branch managers within Lincoln-owned real estate. And their job is to create flow specifically for those relationships and augment our national recruiting strategy in the organization. Separately, we have what I call second-tier recruiting relationships. These are the folks that many of you have on contract today that bring you 3, 5, 10 leads a year. They're really not focused on any market. They're sharing those leads with 3, 4, or 5 broker-dealers, depending on the need of that particular advisor. In most cases, they're working for the advisor, not the broker-dealer. So you can take a hybrid approach to this, and you can expand and contract your model depending on what your recruiting objective is in the marketplace. The other structure that I think some firms are doing well is the branch recruiting structure. So having, again, a very well-defined or articulated recruiting strategy built under branch, under a branch manager can be beneficial. We have a program we call Branch Link that provides subsidy for a recruiter if they hire that recruiter within their branch that mirrors some of the compensation that you'd provide to a third-party recruit. Our organization is built in that very branch-centric environment, so it works well in our model. It also creates a retention component to those relationships. We talked a little bit earlier on in the presentation about one of your opportunities for growth is capitalizing on that next generation of advisors and having a program that helps onboard and train those individuals. At the same time, having some infrastructure that can take in these breakaway brokers and help them be successful in an independent environment, that's really your branch recruiting initiative. And if you prop these individuals up in your organization, they're going to be committed to you longer term. You're going to help them grow their revenues, but you're also creating a solution for that next generation of advisors within the marketplace. The one best practice I would encourage you, whether you're using a third-party recruiting firm or you're hiring out recruiting staff, is align the compensation with the profitability characteristics of that recruit and the longevity of that recruit. Oftentimes, I talk with different business development heads, and they pay a one-time headcount bonus, or they pay a one-time upfront bonus with a short-term trail. I encourage you to have some type of long-term compensation in place in the form of a trail, and then have that tied to the profitability characteristics of that relationship. So if they bring somebody on board and that individual isn't successful because they didn't do a good job at acting as the gatekeeper, their compensation is haircut, similar to your compensation as a broker-dealer. Mary, any thoughts or perspective?
Yeah, well, what I would add, and Chris had mentioned this before, is no matter what avenue you take in recruiting, what is important is to plan and execute it and measure it, like Chris said before. And I'll talk a little bit about outsourcing. There are several ways in which you can outsource an executive search firm. You can retain them, as Chris mentioned, on a monthly retainer or an upfront retainer, and then a back end when they are successful. And that's where you're going to get your most commitment from an executive search firm. And, you know, they're going to partner with you. Most of the firms that I've worked with, I've visited their home office, and I know their story, and I know their culture, and I've met with all the executives. So that is definitely beneficial when I'm out there recruiting. You can do contingency. I'm sure you all get calls from recruiters that have these big groups, and, you know, like Chris said, they're working for the advisor, and they're just really shopping that advisor around. It's really little commitment to your firm. Another way is, for as far as compensating the recruiter, you can do a trail, a percentage of their production for 1 to 2 years, a flat fee, and then there's also the opportunity to just use a contracting firm to align with you if you have a big push or you've got a certain goal to meet or a certain market, as in St. Louis, like Chris mentioned. And the other thing I would add, and just with the branch office recruiting, is that is a great place to use your mentorship program to get the younger people in to grow that branch.
We're going to start going through this information on a time check here. We're a little behind. The recruiting process, I think, is critical in any organization. I don't think there's one template for it. I think the general components of the recruiting process involve 6 key steps. It's your prospect assessment. It's the selling process, how you gain trust with that advisor, selling the first the recruiter, and then the organization and product and concepts of their organization. We could spend a whole 2 hours on sort of sales concepts and sales approaches from a recruiting perspective. We really don't want to get into that here. There's the presentation of the offer. There's the commitment that you want to gain from that prospect, onboarding, and then sort of the post-integration of the prospect. Mary's going to spend a little time talking about prospect assessment. What we think here, what we think is important in any recruiting process, again, is have a process. A well-defined sales process and how you present a consistent story message to prospective representatives and add value every interaction with that prospect and have a commitment objective at each interaction with that prospect. So something that you want to accomplish on that call for that meeting with that individual. Merritt, just spend a little time.
Candidate profiling is very critical, and as I talk to senior leaders in broker-dealers, is you want to find out the basic information. You know, what's their motivation to make a change? What is their product mix? What are their assets under management? How long have they been at the firm? And get the succession of when they've moved from firm to firm. But some questions that I like to ask, and I've been told by several executives at broker-dealers, is they don't get enough notes from the recruiter, whether it's internal or external, is take copious notes when you're talking to these people. I always ask them what keeps them up at night. You know, what's the main driving force that you're talking to me right now? And another question I like to ask with advisors and also in my executive search practice is, what are your top 3 life's greatest accomplishments? Because then you can come back and address those at a later time, too. But that's very interesting in getting to know a candidate. Home office visit, I just wanted to, we didn't have too much information on that. But in talking to leaders of broker-dealers, too, when you're bringing the advisors to the home office, it's very critical that you have aligned them with strategic people in your firm that have seen the profile that I just talked about. Make a value proposition on the candidate and make sure that the people that they're meeting in the home office, you all meet the day before bringing the candidate in and everyone sees that value proposition on the candidate.
The thing I'd add here is sometimes you're defined by who you don't select to join your organization. If you identify somebody that's not a good fit for your company, move them out quickly and move on to the next candidate. Many times the recruiter, if you allow them to, will rationalize why this individual is a good fit for the organization, has some line of sight on the prospects your company's entertaining, and make sure you extinguish those that aren't good fits quickly in the process. The other part that could be beneficial, depending on the frequency of it, is having a formal selection committee so that the organization, if it's culturally right for your company, is collectively making that decision on who affiliates with your company. The next steps really talk about transition and onboarding. Just quickly here, what's important, again, is have a process. there's two different ways to approach the transition process. There's many companies out there that are very capable of handling transitions on behalf of a broker-dealer. So if you don't have the infrastructure or capacity to bring on a transition team, this is something that you can outsource within your organization. There's companies out there that do this. Brokers Express, Hardy Hanks, or be a couple that exist out there that do a really good job. So what you want to determine for your company based on the frequency that you have with new recruits coming on is, does it make sense for you to staff a full transition team in your organization? The other part is making sure you have a very defined transition process that you can communicate to the prospective representative so that they know where they need to be at each step in the process when they're going through a pre-transition environment as well as the post-transition environment. Want to talk about some onboarding pieces, Mary?
Well, you want to have a written project plan when you bring someone on. Bring them in, treat it like an event, make their first day a big deal with the employees and their group if they're bringing a group on. Have the president or senior leadership call and welcome them to the organization. Another good thing is to maybe send something special to their spouse at home, a coffee basket or flowers, or bring lunch for the advisor group. Have one point of contact, the relationship manager, that's going to help this advisor segue and, you know, get them into the practice management group. And then the special code paperwork, just the details of making them comfortable and getting them up to speed as soon as they can.
What we need by the special code is some organizations will put a sticker on the paperwork as it comes in, so everybody in the organization knows that this is a new representative, and to treat that individual as a valued customer. It's a new experience that sets the precedence for how they're going to interact with your organization going forward. If you screw up the transition process, it's very difficult to recover that relationship several months down the road. How you handle that individual's business during that first few months is critical. To Jason or David's point, make sure you have a business liaison in each critical department or area of your organization so that this individual has a point of contact beyond just the transition liaison or transition consultant. Post-transition integration, have a formal transition release or process within your organization. In effect, you want to certify what that individual has learned during the transition process and make it a celebratory event within your organization some way, whether it's certifying that individual, sending out some type of press release, having some organizational acknowledgement that this individual has come through the transition successfully, I think is going to be critical in any organization. And then you want to have, from a marketing perspective, Terry talks about marketing, is all the things that the advisor viewed and valued during the recruiting process that made them want to be with your organization oftentimes get left behind during the transition. They forget why they joined your organization. They go back to doing everything that they were doing in the past. And if you were to interview these advisors, 12, 18 months down the road and ask them about the different things that you provide in your organization, there's going to be some forgetfulness there. So have a systematic process to incrementally reintroduce those things that differentiated you in the market, in the marketplace against your broker-dealer peers. I refer to this just simply as a cross-selling or upselling program within your organization. Again, think about how an adult learner is going to learn. They learn in modules and apply those same concepts to your new advisors. Have a formal referral gathering process during that transition process. So when I'm sitting with a prospective representative who then joins my organization, I tell that individual, I'm going to come to you in 90 days when you're released from transition, and I'm going to ask you for the name of two or three of your colleagues. If I have met your expectations and everything I shared with you was going to occur through the transition process, would you be comfortable giving me the names of two or three of your colleagues, yes or no? Generally speaking, that goes well, and we're able to cultivate those relationships. That individual becomes a champion for your organization. Sort of some other recruiting best practices. Again, these aren't critical to any organization to be successful in recruiting, but if you have CRM, use CRM. It's a great way to stay in touch with your prospect. It's a great way to measure, which you're probably not measuring today. So we measure when a prospect comes into the organization, the close time. We weight prospects in different categories, cold, warm, and hot. I know, very sophisticated, but that's what we do. And I can tell you with some degree of accuracy what the affiliation period, how long it takes to migrate a prospect through our process to eventually join the organization using CRM applications. It also allows us to manage that relationship prospectively. So when I want our president of the broker-dealer to contact that individual, I have a notifier there that goes out to our transition team, for example, that prompts an introductory letter to go out. Use CRM to your advantage. If you're not today, transition or recruiting and transition survey is a great way to measure how the advisor was introduced to your organization, what they learned about your organization, have they had a successful transition, how would they grade the recruiting process separately from the transition process. This allows you to make the adjustments you need to make in your recruiting team, both from a training perspective as well as in your process within the organization. Design employee incentive plans with the end in mind. I think this is critical. Somebody in the audience said recruiting is a team effort. That means the entire organization. So if you have some type of annual incentive plan or employee recognition plan that involves compensation, weight that compensation to the metrics that matter most in your organization. If recruiting's a priority, that needs to be weighted appropriately. If retention's a priority, that needs to be weighted appropriately. If net income's a priority, that needs to be weighted appropriately. If moving assets into a fee-based platform's a priority, that needs to be weighted appropriately. You want to compensate for the behaviors that you expect. And that also ties into what we said about tying your recruiting compensation to the long-term success and profitability of that recruit. I know a lot of you aren't part of protocol, and you need to do is determine if protocol is appropriate for your firm, especially if you're going to participate in the breakaway brokers. Anybody that's not aware of what that is or how to become protocol, certainly give me a call, and I can put you in touch with the right people. Again, you want to make sure your privacy policy is aligned with the criteria and protocol agreement, meaning you have the ability to take certain client information and operate outside of the concern with Reg SP. Establish a formal referral program. Going back to some of the earlier slides here, referrals are the second most important source of new leads for any organization. You need to have a program that recognizes the referrer and celebrates that in your organization on a repeat basis. Post quarterly updates with industry centers of influence. There's a lot of centers of influence in our industry, starting with wholesalers to industry publications to third-party recruiters. Make sure you're getting your story out to anybody that can share that in the marketplace. It's going to be critical, I think, to your long-term success, and it's free advertising and word of mouth for your organization. Include the same individuals as recipients of your marketing initiative, but give them the option to opt out. Not everybody likes to receive multiple repeat emails from your organization. So determine what's a priority as it relates to the information that you're sharing and don't spam them or beat them to death with too much information. If you host a home office visit, make it a positive and memorable experience. I think Mary's already touched on some of this. So.
And one thing with the home office visit, too, before they leave, have a follow-up with them. And, you know, ask, is there anything that would preclude you from joining our firm? So you can get those last issues that are important to them and address them.
Mary, I'll interject. One of the things I do, and we're fortunate, we can fingerprint right on our site. So that usually is my success at the end of the meeting. You know, hey,
if they allow you to fingerprint them.
Let's get the fingerprints done today. That way we have them, you don't have a hassle.
Absolutely. That's good. Good suggestion.
The assumptive close. Very, very, very meaningful. Just quickly, concluding thoughts, I think we've probably exhausted some of these points here. The idea is that there's a great deal of opportunity in the chaos I think we're going to go through over the next few years. That opportunity and your ability to capitalize on it is going to be largely dependent on your brand awareness, and the process you've built around both recruiting and onboarding prospective representatives. And more importantly, I think it's critical that you make equally important retention of your existing advisors to your organization. With that, we'll shut down 5 minutes late.
All right, great, thank you. There's a lot of great information on these slides, so I would really encourage you all to go on to the FSI website and pull these down so you can refer to this information. It's great stuff.